And our last appeal this morning is Tillis versus the Columbus Police Department. Okay, I think we're supposed to see Mr. Couch too on the screen. I know Ms. Tucker is going to be participating by phone. Okay, Mr. Couch. I just want to make sure we had everybody. Mr. Christina?
Yes, sir.
Will you speak with us, please?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. My name is Thomas Christina, and may it please the court, and good morning. It's my privilege to represent the appellants in this case. Your Honors, this is a Fourth Amendment excessive force case where 21 shots were fired in less than 13 seconds following an extended 14-minute high-speed pursuit and crash. And Your Honors are well aware of the standards. It is a constitutional Fourth Amendment case involving qualified immunity issues. The district court, whom I have an immense amount of respect for, got it right with respect to the first 11 shots. He unfortunately got it wrong with respect to the second 10. I'm gonna get to the facts in a moment, but I'd like to point out the clear law in this case with respect to qualified immunity, which requires clearly the right to be clearly established with specificity, and that except in obvious cases of obvious clarity where constitutional rights are violated, the standard requires identifying a controlling case where an officer was acting under similar circumstances was held to have violated the Fourth Amendment. And in fact, the Supreme Court in Emmons in 2019 pointed out that in the Fourth Amendment context, that where the court has recognized that it is sometimes difficult for an officer to determine how the relevant excessive force legal doctrine will apply to the factual situation the officer confronts, specificity is extremely important, and that use of force.
Yes, sir. I've watched a video here. There's only one, right? That would be informative of both rounds of shots. That is the car dash video.
Correct.
And it shows what happened immediately before the first round of shots. That is, the plaintiff's car went into reverse after the officer stepped out of his vehicle.
Correct.
And then Judge Land said that what was unreasonable was an excessive, or at least there would be evidence to support it, was the second round of shots. We hear that on the video, but we don't see that on the video. There's no video that would show us that, right?
Correct.
And I know the officer had testified that he heard the engine revving, but it seems that the record has some dispute of fact about that. Am I right to say, though, that there's no dispute that the engine was at least running?
Correct. You were correct on that, Your Honor.
And that the lights of that vehicle were on. There's no dispute about that, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And what separates the first round of shots from the second round of shots is approximately 6 seconds while the officer loads a new clip. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor, with the additional facts that he was loading the clip off balance after having nearly been run over. But it was just at 6 seconds before he elected to fire the second 10 rounds of shots.
Okay. That's what I wanted to know.
Yes, sir. And I would add that the record is also undisputed that it was a dark area in a residential neighborhood where the only other source of light was an unlit lamppost. And I'm going to focus my argument, Your Honors, on the second 10 shots, because I think that's the harder part of the case. This court has issued 8 opinions preceding
Counsel,
this event.
Before we get to that, let me ask this. Could, and this is, dozen or eight sentences, but it seems to me like Judge Land's reasoning on the second round of shots, set out on page 28 and 29 of his order, and this is key. I want to read these and I want to ask you which one of them cannot be supported based on the plaintiff's version of facts, that is the evidence in the record construed in the light most favorable to the plaintiff. Under plaintiff's version of the facts, Brown was 15 feet away from the Pontiac when he reloaded his weapon. The 6 seconds after the first 11 shots, but before the second round, Brown did not seek cover. Instead, he began walking toward the Pontiac, which was either slowly rolling backwards or had come to a gentle stop to effect an arrest. Then he shot an additional 10 bullets. The Pontiac never moved forward toward Brown. And under the plaintiff's version of the facts, Brown's sole justification for the second round of the shots, a loud revving noise that prompted him to believe the Pontiac might be accelerating towards him, did not happen. All right. Now, you may dispute that those are the facts, but which of those facts do you dispute that the evidence interpreted in the light most favorable to these plaintiffs wouldn't support that statement of facts?
I don't dispute any of those, Your Honor. But if okay. I may respond as to how Judge Land got it wrong with that, respectfully to Judge Land, because the standard is an objective one, and an officer in that situation would have been thinking about not only the Pontiac, which is the deadly weapon, he would have been thinking about the other officers who were rapidly approaching the scene, including Officer Turner, who we know is very close. He would have also been thinking about the citizens who were in the area. The suspect had already crashed into one residential front yard. He was heading into a neighborhood in Phoenix City that is densely...
Well, so is your argument, Mr. Christina, I want to make sure I understand it, is that if the officer could have reasonably fired the first round of shots, that as he faced that car that was a threat to his safety, because the car was still running, the lights were still shining in his face, that dangerous weapon, that car, was still available, and he didn't have to wait and hope for the best. He could continue to use force to neutralize that threat.
Yes, sir, Your Honor, that's my argument, and it comports with the court's cases. I didn't specifically get into the facts of the McCullough-Antolini case in our brief, although it's cited. In that case, the officers, actually, there were 3 rounds of shots, the third round coming as the car was literally driving away from the officers, and the officers ran alongside it and engaged in something that was dangerous enough that one of them warned, watch the crossfire. If in that case no constitutional violation was found, then certainly none would be found here, because as in that case, there was no.
It seems though that Judge Land seems to be that his thought process though was that because that vehicle had come to a stop or was gently still rolling backwards, that it no longer posed the same threat that it did when the first round of shots was fired, and it was moving toward the officer. Is that right?
Yes, sir. And I agree that's where he was going with it, but he is imposing an interlude in the action that cannot be imposed upon reasonable officers under those circumstances. The circumstances simply didn't allow time or require Officer Brown to step back and, as you stated, and as the case law is clear, to wait and hope for the best. And literally, the second volley was fired 9 seconds after the event began. So it is an incredibly tight set of time. And as in the McCullough case, where there was no interlude, this was a fluid event that has to be taken in context with all that had happened leading up to it. The chase, nearly being run over, having to reload off balance, not knowing whether or not he had incapacitated the driver or the car, and then being faced with the car still in front of him, again, after the first round of shots. And in those circumstances, a law enforcement officer, if they wait, they could be killed. And to focus again on the qualified immunity argument, at that time, Officer Brown couldn't be expected to parse the cases. The eight cases that precede, all of which are cited in our brief, that preceded the event, the original one being Pace, and leading all the way up and including McCullough and others, all tell officers that they're entitled to use deadly force if it's initially justified until the threat is clearly over. And that, of course, comports with the four Supreme Court cases that we cite, beginning with Brousseau.
Mr. Christina, I want to ask you some questions about, because of the related nature of your argument between the first shots and the second shots, I want to make sure I understand the facts about the first shots. So here, there's no indication that the occupants of the car had a weapon, is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And there had been a high-speed chase that preceded the car wrecking or coming to a stop, but the car had not been used as a weapon. In other words, the folks in the car had not directed the car at an officer or anybody else at that point. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. And so the question is whether Officer Brown could have thought that he was, could reasonably have thought he was in danger by virtue of the car backing up. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. And was there anything other than the fact that the car began backing up to support a reasonable belief?
Only the circumstances leading up to it, Your Honor, given the high pressure situation that was involved, that somebody would engage in a chase of that magnitude, crossing state lines for so long, and then put the car into reverse towards the officer. So the threat of the vehicle is the justification for
after the officer left the vehicle and is standing nearly behind it.
Yes, sir, Your Honor. And the facts are in this record, based on their own expert, are undisputed that Officer Brown was very close to the right and rear of that vehicle as it came into reverse. And given the authority, there's Legion authority.
That's everything, right? That's everything you've got.
For the first set of shots, yes, Your Honor. That's right.
Is there any case that speaks only of a high-speed chase? In other words, some of the cases mention that the car was directed at officers or run into the path of oncoming vehicles. Is there any case that says simply the fact that there was a high-speed chase can create sort of an inference of danger for the officers?
Well, I think Scott v. Harris was one in the Supreme Court. And then if you look at Long v. Slayton, in that tragic case, the young man was killed simply because he got into the police car and was driving away and deadly force.
Oh, right, but the court rested its reasoning in the Long case on the fact that it was a police vehicle.
Yes, but then I would rely on Scott v. Harris, which was just a chase. And I think Breschers as well. I'm not sure, but the facts have come together in many of those, but I believe Breschers as well may have just been a high-speed chase. My time has expired.
Judge Jill Pryor, do you have any more questions?
No, thank you.
Okay. Yes, sir, Mr. Christina. You saved 3 minutes for rebuttal. We'll hear next from Mr. Couch.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Steve Couch. I'm from Hoover, Alabama, and I represent the estate of Christian Redwine. Your Honors, as you know, this appeal involves both an appeal from them and one from us. So what we've done as counsel for the appellees for this part, we've divided this case topically. I'm going to speak to what's been referred to as the first volley or first round of shots. Mr. Post, who represents Hannah Wunschel, he's going to speak to the second round or the second volley of shots. And Ms. Tucker, Renee Tucker, who represents Hunter Tillis, she is going to speak to any remaining legal factual issues and hopefully correct anything that I mess up. Your Honor, at its core, our appeal is that the court below Judge Land, respectfully to him, he got it wrong in the first volley of shots.
And yeah, the problem for me is, as you probably know, I was on the panel in Singletary versus Vargas, and we held that the sheriff's deputy there acted reasonably when he used deadly force against a driver who he reasonably believed was trying to run over him with a car. That looks to me like the first round of shots, at least.
Well, let me tell you why that's not an accurate factual conclusion anyway, Judge. In fact, it was the conclusion that was reached by Judge Land when he decided as a matter of law, factual questions that should have been left to a jury. Let me tell you what I mean. And I'm just going to give you two examples.
I've seen the video.
Okay. Well, there was a body cam.
I know the officer has left the car. I know that he's standing behind it from the way the shots entered the car, including through the rear view window. I know that the car has backed up in the direction that he has just left the car. What am I missing?
Well, what you're missing, Judge, is where he was standing in those first 3 to 5 shots anyway, was in the V of his car or just outside the open door. And
you don't have to be standing directly behind it to be standing near enough to reasonably perceive it to be a weapon. That was the case in Singletary versus Vargas.
Well, you have to have an imminent and immediate threat of physical harm or danger. Mm-hmm. He was in a position of safety, and we can show that with a testimony of Hunter Tillis, Ms. Wunschel, and the missing body camera that was never produced in this case. And that Officer Brown was wearing that morning, according to his commanding officer, according to the sergeant, and according to other two other high-level officers who said it would make sense that he had it when he was under closely monitored status.
So your position is that if you had the missing video or tape or whatnot, you could prove your case.
It would conclusively show where he is, and it's a piece of objective evidence.
But you don't have it.
I don't have it because we think we captured on video Officer Brown spoliating that evidence. And it was captured, that act was captured
officer. What did the district court, did you ask the district court to have a hearing and give us an order or an instruction that we can get past summary judgment with, that the jury will be required to find that as a fact, that he was in a position of safety and wasn't about to be run over? Is that how you preserve the issue?
I brought it up at no, Judge, to answer your question directly, but I did bring it up at summary judgment and told him there was evidence of this missing body cam that would show that he was in a position of safety. Candidly, there's no other reason for him to have gotten rid of it if it showed what he said it showed.
I'm having difficulty finding how you preserve this issue other than complaining about the fact that the evidence didn't exist anymore and you expect that he destroyed it. Did you the district court to rule in this case that it was a fact that, not that he spoiled the evidence, but it was therefore a fact that he was in a position of safety and wasn't about to be run over and so forth and so on? Did you ask for that?
I didn't ask for that because it creates a genuine issue of fact that should have been sent to a jury, Judge. It's the only thing it could have been.
But you have an obligation to tell the judge what the facts are that would create that genuine issue.
I did, Judge. And he said, what he said to me was, well, I'm not going to put much weight on that. Mr. Christina would certainly appeal me if I did that. I don't know why he said that, Judge, honestly. And there's a number of other factual determinations that he made about where Officer Brown was standing, and that's the crux of the case. And there's evidence that he was behind his engine block, a position of safety where he was trained to take, and he could fire from that. And he did start firing from that shot, eventually moving closer to the car. But I know those first 3 to 5 shots, maybe 7, were taken from a position of safety, and there's genuine issues of fact regarding that. And he should have sent that to a jury, Judge.
Mr. Couch, what is the significance of the plaintiff's testimony that he was standing between the car and the door in the V of the door of his vehicle?
Because it's further evidence. And by the way, that testimony matches what Officer Brown told the Alabama law enforcement agency. It shows that he was in a position of safety behind his engine block, behind his car, behind his door. That's where you're trained to be.
Wasn't the door on the same side as the plaintiff's car?
He was between the V of his car and his patrol car door, and the plaintiff's the Pontiac was in the front, and it was backing up.
I mean, what would have happened if the Pontiac had hit that door with full force?
It couldn't have gotten there from the angle that it was sitting, Judge. It's not possible. The car's not big enough to do that.
So what difference does it make that he was behind the door if the car couldn't have got there anyway?
Because he shot from a position of state safety. At least that's where he started shooting from.
And you're being inconsistent, it seems like to me, counsel. Let me tell you why I think that. either that door added protection to him or it did not. If the car, if the door was between him and the car, that is no protection at all. If the defendant's theory is that the car was headed towards him, because you just get sandwiched and crushed to death if the car hits a door in that situation. So that the existence, I don't understand how the existence of the door adds anything.
Well,
he hit with the door against his body, or his body's going to be hit, or he's not going to be hit. And if he's not going to be hit, the door is irrelevant.
Isn't the significance of the door to show where he was standing with respect to his car and the other car?
That's part of it, Judge Pryor. And it the door does offer you protection. That's what they're trained for, felony stops, the engine block, the car and the door. He could have backed up anything, but that's the point. That's where he was standing, a position of safety. He could not have been run over by that car that was backing up at this angle right here. And you know, it's certainly contradictory to the four other places that he placed himself when he's talking to various, he being Officer Brown, talking to various other investigatory agency. I mean, he changes the story five times.
Mr. Couch, we've allowed you to go significantly over, but you've been answering our questions and we appreciate it. We need to hear from Mr. Post.
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Mark Post. I represent Hannah Winchell, the young lady, the blonde-haired young lady that I'm sure each of you have seen in the video. I am, as Mr. Couch said, to address the second volley of shots that was fired, the second volley of 10 shots, where I think Mr. Christina misses the point is where in their reply brief, they say that it is axiomatic that once deadly force became justified, Brown did not have to stop shooting until the threat was clearly over and the scene was fully secure. While that may be true to some extent,
our Jean Baptiste opinion certainly seems to support that argument.
I didn't hear you, Judge.
Our Jean Baptiste decision certainly seems to support that argument.
Yes, they cited that in their brief, but I think that is distinguishable, as Judge Land distinguished all of these cases in his order, and we have distinguished them in our brief, in that the situation changed. If
that was the argument in Jean Baptiste, the gun had fallen on the ground, and therefore he should have stopped the volley.
At that
point, and we said he doesn't, you know, that whether on the ground or in his hand, it's still readily accessible, and the officer doesn't need to stop and hope for the best. If the officer was threatened reasonably enough to where he could fire the first volley of shots, and this car is still running, the lights are still on, and it still poses the threat to him. Why isn't it the same argument that he doesn't have to wait and hope for the best?
I think it's Baptiste is different because in that case, there was some evidence that the officer could not have or may not have seen the firearm. It was not in a location where the officer, when he was reassessing, would have necessarily seen the firearm, if I recall correctly. And that's a totally different situation.
I don't remember that distinction in Jean Baptiste.
Maybe I'm confusing it with another case. I know Your Honor was on that case. But I think it is distinguishable in that the firearm, the police officer knew he was armed, and the firearm was not very far away. And thus, it is very easy to discharge a firearm from any distance. The vehicle.
Pretty easy to hit the accelerator, too, of a car.
That's true, but not after 11 rounds have already gone into the car, where the police officer was in a position of safety and did not fall back, but instead chose to go forward toward the car. And we use a 15-foot difference or distance from the vehicle for the second volley of shots, but I think that is for the end of the shots, because where the car, where the patrol car was on a slight hill. And as the police officer went up the hill to approach the Pontiac on the other side of the road, and you can hear when he, during the interlude, as Brown described it as a second engagement, you can actually hear the magazine hitting the ground. And from that point, the evidence would show that Brown moved kind of in an arcing position towards the Pontiac and re-engaged it. And when he's doing all that, he has plenty of time to see that the vehicle is disabled. It had rolled very slowly back across the road. Hannah Winchell was screaming this whole time. Her window had been shot out. You can hear her on the
video. She's screaming. She's not the driver.
That's right.
The lights are still on. The engine's still running. How is the officer to know it's been disabled?
Because
it no longer poses a threat to him?
It's not moving. He can see that. He can assess the vehicle. If you take it that once that he does not have to reassess at that point, we have a number of cases that say you do have to reassess. And if you do not, then you're violating constitutional rights. If, for instance, in...
Do either of my colleagues have any further questions?
No.
Okay, Mr. Post, I think we understand your argument. Your time has expired. Ms. Tucker, you still have, you have 5 minutes. Will you speak with us, please?
Yes, is everyone able to hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you. May it please the Honorable Court, just in assessing the questions that the court has asked up to this point, we think that it's important to reiterate that we understand that what this court says matters. And as the court noted in an earlier oral argument today, what the Supreme Court says matters, because these cases in your circuit, in the 11th Circuit, and in the Supreme Court, they are instructive to the courts below. And we do believe, as we've indicated in our brief, that this court has given us instructions. They've given us instructions in Vaughn versus Cox. And as Judge Pryor asked earlier when Mr. Christina was speaking, what do the cases about high-speed chases actually say when it comes to the use of force? Vaughn v. Cox is extremely instructive because there you do have a police chase. You have a police chase that started and you have a police chase that ended. You have a situation where, as Judge Pryor noted, that the vehicle, the Pontiac in this particular case, throughout the chase, that Pontiac is not documented anywhere that that car presented a harm or a threat to anyone. Once that car stopped, there's still no evidence from the plaintiff's, from the
cross appellant. Ms. Tucker, as soon as that vehicle engages in reverse, after the officer has left his vehicle, I would say it poses a threat then.
Respectfully, Your Honor, we would disagree. We believe that the facts as have been presented shows in this court when questioning my co-counsel earlier asked a couple of times about that issue. And if you look at the word behind, yes, theoretically was the police officer's vehicle behind the Pontiac, theoretically, yes, but it was behind the Pontiac and off to the side. So the question is not what Officer Brown would have done, but it's based on that.
That's a lot like Singletary versus Vargas, where the officer is approaching the vehicle, and as he approaches it to the side, close to the front, the vehicle moves. And he immediately fires shots because he perceives it as a threat. We say motor vehicles are dangerous weapons, and we said the officer was entitled to qualified immunity.
And Your Honors, respectfully, we believe that Singletary is certainly distinguishable. I think the facts in Singletary, there was more evidence that the officer was actually physically approaching the vehicle, taking the facts in the light most favorable to the appellees and the
cross-appellants. I've seen the video. I know that this officer was at least approaching the vehicle in the sense that he had left his own vehicle and was closer to that vehicle than he had, in a more precarious position than he would have been had he remained in his own vehicle.
And Your Honor, that's why we believe, as the court has indicated in Singletary and the other 11th Circuit guiding opinions, that each fact matters. In this particular case, each shot matters. When we're looking at that first volley of shots, every shot is important. When you see where shots 1 through 5 went, we still have to evaluate shots 6 through 11. Because at a certain point in time, you have an officer that is faced with a vehicle that, from the appellee's and cross-appellant's position, he was never physically behind it such that he was actually in harm's way from an objective officer's position. But then as that vehicle continues to move past him during this first volley of shots, he's shooting into the side windows of a moving a vehicle that's moving away from him.
Some of the shots go through the rear window, do they not?
Yes, 1 through 5, Your Honor, yes. But when we look at shot 7...
that he was at least standing enough behind it to where that was where the shots went.
Respectfully, no, Your Honor. We believe that he can be standing off to the side of that vehicle and still make those shots based on the trajectories. Yeah. This is the issue of one from... I'm sorry if I interrupted the court.
No, that's right. But it's not just beside. It's enough behind, too.
And it still raises the question as to whether or not, when we're looking even at those shots, what a reasonable officer would have done in that position. We believe that the facts, at least as they have been presented, show a case where you have Officer Brown arrives to the scene after the vehicle is stopped. You have the Pontiac attempting to reverse when Officer Brown is still in a safe position and from that vehicle. And in order to stop that vehicle from fleeing, he began shooting. So that is the analysis that we're saying that should have been utilized in the court below. And we believe that Vaughn v. Cox is one of those cases that's extremely instructive. And when we also look at Tennessee v. Gardner, those cases tell us, and they tell Officer Brown, that he should not have been shooting at that particular time because there was no imminent harm.
Counsel, Vaughn involved an entirely different situation, which was speeding down the interstate. As I recall, it was 85 going into Atlanta, busy highway. And the officer was shooting at the plaintiff's vehicle with other cars around it while the police officer's car was being driven at a high rate of speed. That's a different situation than you have here.
Yes, sir. But when we look at the continuing facts in that case, you have a driver in that case that refused to stop. You have a situation where the driver was suspected of car theft. That was the extent of the suspected crime. And you have a situation where
the driver was not, I believe we said in that case, not should have, that the police officers enhanced the danger to innocent people and enhanced the dangers to others than the plaintiffs. In that case.
Yes, Your Honor, but we believe the premise of that case shows us that in a situation where an officer is faced with no severe crime, a suspected car theft, for example, no immediate threat to the safety of others as this vehicle is backing and moving away from the officer and the issue of flight, this is one where the individuals were known to Officer Brown. We believe there's sufficient evidence that demonstrates he knew who was in the vehicle. He knew there were passengers in the vehicle. He knew where they lived and could be apprehended later.
Okay, Ms. Tucker, I think we understand your argument, and we've got 3 minutes left for Mr. Christina.
Thank you, Your Honor. Vaughn is also distinguishable, Judge Carnes, on the basis that the speed of the car, I believe it was only 10 miles an hour over the speed limit, and the court had some concerns with that. By contrast, our case, the Pontiac reached 107 miles an hour on a 65, maybe 55 with that J.R. Allen location is, and then had the obvious events leading up to that were going through residential neighborhoods down the running red lights, stop signs, a much different chase. Your Honors, in this case, Officer Brown was confronted with a situation that never stopped in that last 13 seconds. He didn't have a chance to pause. Had he paused and assumed hope for the best, he might have been run over. He didn't have the ability to know whether or not Hunter Christian Redwine was dead. He didn't know those things. He couldn't know. He couldn't see in the car. The headlights were in his face. It was dark. The adrenaline was racing through him. He had nearly been run over. Under those circumstances, the body of case law in this country, Supreme Court, 11th Circuit, not only says it's okay what he did, but if it wasn't, then this would be new law. There is no case in the 11th Circuit that would have told Officer Brown that night, you can't fire those second 10 shots. There are cases that say you can fire the first 11 and the second 10, we believe, but there's certainly none that would have told him, okay, wait a minute, that car is rolling to a slow stop. You got to wait and see what happens next. If we want to establish a rule like that in the 11th Circuit, then certainly that may happen. If that does, we disagree with it, he would be entitled to qualified immunity. That would be a new case, and Officer Brown would be exonerated for the existing facts. We believe Officer Brown got it right that night. No doubt it was a tragedy, but in that circumstance, he didn't have time to parse the case law, and even if he had, he wouldn't have seen anything to tell him to stop. What he would have seen was, you have the right to use deadly force until the threat is clearly over. And when was that to him? That was when Hunter Tillis got out of the rear left passenger seat. And he was reloading his third magazine. He testified to that. But he saw Hunter Tillis get out. He couldn't tell if he assumed he was the driver because he got out of the driver's side. It was the wrong assumption. Had Christian Redwine been alive, he might have been dead. But he made the assumption that was Tillis, and he stopped. That was the interlude in the case, and that's why deadly force stopped that night. That was the correct decision for Officer Brown. Your Honor, appreciate your time. We ask that you affirm Judge Land with respect to the first 11 shots and reverse him respectfully with respect to the second 10. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Christina. That concludes our arguments for today. We will be in recess until tomorrow morning.
Thank you, Judge.